Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Good evening. I've been expecting you. Won't you join me?
It's that time of year again. The leaves are changing colors. Cool fog rolls across the hills and valleys in the morning. People start drinking pumpkin spice lattes and lagers. And there are spiders. Lots and lots of spiders. That can only mean that Halloween is right around the corner and time for another one of our annual off-kilter and spooky All Souls Day episodes. In past years, we've featured shows on Bigfoot, monster movies, ancient aliens, and the funeral industry, all of which we will link to on our website and will be posting links to on our Facebook and Twitter feeds. Although admittedly, these are all odd things for scholars to be studying, in reality, an examination of these topics can provide interesting insights into human behavior. And today's guest, Dr. Peter Leeson, who happens to be one of my most favorite living scholars, is no exception to that rule. As a professor of economics at George Mason University, Pete has explored a wide range of topics that would seem off-limits to economists, such as soccer hooligans, gypsy law, monastic curses, and vermin trials, wherein he explains why rats were often sued during the Middle Ages. Yeah, I'm not kidding. Rats were taken to court and were tried. He is the author of two fantastic books, Anarchy Unbound, Why Self-Governance Works Better Than You Think, and The Invisible Hook, The Hidden Economics of Pirates, a book that I have used for the past 5 years in many of my undergraduate and graduate classes and is at the top of the list as my students' most favoritest book. He has also authored and co-authored more articles than I can count on a wide range of economic topics, and he is some 15 years younger than me, which makes me insanely jealous. Youth and productivity, huh? You can find links to his books and his personal website, which includes most of his article publications, over at our website. So as soon as you're done listening today, head on over there and click those links. You're going to want to read that paper on vermin trials. Trust me, it's a really good one. Pete, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thanks so much for having me, Tony. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, it's fun talking to you. I had a chance to meet you in person about a year ago, and you're just an absolutely fascinating scholar. And you do all these eclectic topics that most scholars wouldn't think of. And I just have to bring this up because one of the banes of being an academic is that as soon as somebody finds out what you do, it changes the conversation on everything. So the minute I tell somebody, yes, I'm a professor of political science, immediately the first question that comes out of their mouth is, who's going to win the next election? Which they'll look at them blankly and say, well, I don't know. And then I usually just scurry over to the corner where there's some hors d'oeuvres and just eat quietly and try not to be bothered anymore. You must really face a similar situation with studying vermin trials and monastic curses and all these different things. Do you have that similar experience?
Yeah, I have a similar experience. You know, for an economist, the question that you often get is, what's going to happen to the stock market?
Yeah.
And that happens to me all the time. And I have a similar response. You know, usually I say, you know, if I had the answer to that question or if I could reliably answer it, I'd be retired on a beach somewhere in the Bahamas, you know, sipping pina coladas or something. And I often also point out that if, in fact, I had that information or if I could reliably answer that question, what makes that person think that I would give it to them for free? That'd be extremely valuable, which is, I guess, sort of their first lesson in economics, which is given to them for free.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's the typical question that an economist gets.
Yeah. So you don't study that. You do have some what we would call conventional economic topics that you talk about. But again, you do a lot of different things. You're one of these Gary Becker-esque type individuals who say, you know, economics can be applied anywhere and everywhere, and you really take that to heart. How do you get away with studying all those topics in academia? I mean, you landed at a great university, George Mason University, econ department, but I mean, fellow economists must kind of stare at you and go, huh?
Yeah, they do. I mean, you know, you hit on the first way. To the extent that I'm able to get away with it, it's in large part because of my terrific colleagues at GMU who have a very sort of Beckerian, as you put it, way of looking at economics that's very broad. On the other hand, you know, sort of outside of GMU, that while there are, of course, exceptions, in many ways I don't get away with it. Economists in particular view what I'm doing not as economics. I think a lot of them aren't sure exactly how to classify it. But, you know, from my perspective and from the perspective of, again, many of the people who I'm fortunate to work with here at GMU, economics is not defined topically, which is where that kind of stock market question that people typically ask comes from. The idea that economics must be concerned with money and finance, which of course it can be, but instead of being topically defined, I see economics as simply within that Beckerian approach, a sort of way of analyzing or an approach to understanding human behavior. And, you know, that approach from my perspective is really basic. Simply, it says that people have goals, that they try to achieve those goals in the best ways that they can, given the constraints that they confront. And in most of my work, it's the importance of those constraints and the differences in those constraints that ends up coming to the foreground. You know, sort of basic takeaway, as we'll probably talk about a little bit more today, the basic takeaway is that the differences in human behavior that we observe across societies and time, and oftentimes the peculiar behaviors that we observe in certain times and places, don't so much reflect fundamental differences in people across societies and time. Rather, they reflect differences in the particular constraints that people who are pursuing often the same goals confronted. And so that's the sort of way that I think about it.
Yeah, that is a great lesson to teach students of economics and basically everybody. And it's a hard lesson for people to learn oftentimes. But the way that you do it with the wide range of topics that you undertake really brings that point home, is that it's just choice under scarcity, and you look at the constraints that people are under, and you can start to see, oh, okay, that's why they make those oddball decisions. And we want to move into some of the oddball decisions today because it's our Halloween episode, and you wrote two papers on witchcraft trials and human sacrifice. And that's one of those areas where Gary Becker pushed the bounds of economics back in the 1960s and talking about marriage markets. But this one is really taking the envelope and pushing it to its max. Witchcraft trials and human sacrifice, people would think would be way out of the boundaries of human rationality. Let's go ahead and start with witchcraft trials. First, how did you stumble on that topic? I mean, where would you think of even thinking about that?
Well, a lot of the particular paper topics that I end up pursuing are the results of research that I was doing for previous papers. So in this particular case, I think with the witch trials paper, I was doing research for some work on medieval judicial ordeals, which is the sort of, I don't know, for any of your listeners who've seen my Python and the Holy Grail, the whole, you know, is she a witch, and is she heavier than a duck, and they've got this beam out and they're trying to balance. That was a judicial ordeal. And for hundreds of years throughout medieval Europe, variations on these types of ordeals, the most common of which was to boil a pot of water, to throw a stone or a ring into it, and then to ask an accused witch or an accused criminal defendant more generally to plunge their arm into the boiling water and to pluck out the object. And the idea was that if they were burned by the water, they would be convicted of the crime of which they stand accused. And if they weren't burned by the water, they'd be exonerated. So, that was medieval judicial ordeals. It turns out that those were not applied to witches for reasons that we'll talk about in a little bit. Were not applied to witches in Middle Ages, but they were in some cases applied to people accused of being witches in the early modern period. And so there was this, in reading about ordeals, there was a footnote about ordeals in the context of witch trials that I just sort of marked as I was reading one of the history books I was looking at for the ordeals paper. And, you know, it's something that I came back to after I finished the Ordeals paper, and that led to the Witch Trials paper. So each one sort of builds on the other in that way. But all of it's only possible because, I should point out more generally, I read a lot of history. I find history fascinating, full of peculiarities and oddities, which, you know, are the kinds of things that I'm interested in. And so that's what brought me to it.
And there's a lesson there for graduate students and undergraduate students, and I think everybody in general as well, is read footnotes, because scholars often put unexplained phenomena into footnotes, saying, well, I really can't explain that. Don't pay attention to it. It's in the bottom of the page. But that is great fodder for future papers. Actually, where I ended up getting my dissertation was from one of these quote-unquote throwaway footnotes.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I mean, I prefer reading the footnotes to reading the text for precisely that reason.
Yeah.
It's just a, you know, a goldmine.
So you get to do a lot of reading in history, and so you know a lot of the territory here. So before we start to get into your explanation of why witchcraft trials occurred in certain places and in certain times, that's really the critical thing that needs explaining here. Give us a lay of the land about witch trials over the medieval period, the early period, the late period. What was going on in Europe?
Sure. Yeah, so the first thing to point out here is that what my co-author and I, my co-author is Jacob Russ, who's actually a graduate student at GMU, who's on the market this year. We did this project together, and what we're focusing on are the what's called the Great Age of European Witch Trials. So these are not the Salem Witch Trials, which, you know, many of your listeners may be more familiar with, but these are, you know, on a much larger scale, much more important in a sense. And we think some of the lessons learned here also apply to the Salem Witch Trials. But in terms of background of the Great Age of European Witch Trials, you know, there's a couple of basic things to sort of give you the lay of the land here and to keep in mind. The first is that popular belief in witches, so belief in witchcraft among laypersons, goes back in Europe at least to the 10th century, so it's very, very old. The other thing, which is sort of peculiar perhaps, or will be strange to many people listening in light of that, is that the Catholic Church's views on witches changed over time, but initially started out as entirely antithetical to witchcraft. So the Church didn't even admit that witches existed. Instead, it characterized belief in witchcraft as a sort of silly superstition, all the way from the 10th century to the beginning of the 15th. So they denied that witches were in fact a genuine phenomenon, and of course they, as a result, were completely unwilling to countenance the prosecution of any persons for witchcraft. In fact, in the 13th century, Pope Alexander IV had to issue a decree in order to prevent some inquisitors from attempting to prosecute persons for witchcraft. So there was this prevailing belief in the lay populace, and also this at least partial demand for prosecuting witches, but the Church said no to all of it. In the 16th century, the beginning of the 16th century, by the time we get there, the Church has done a complete about-face on the issue of witches. Before, witches didn't exist. Now witches exist in droves. They're all over the place throughout Europe. And before, while the Church was unwilling to prosecute witches, now the Church's stance is that, well, anywhere that witches are found, they need to be ferreted out and prosecuted and punished accordingly if they are in fact found to be witches. So there's this sort of weird shift or peculiar shift in the stance on witches within Christendom throughout the sort of medieval moving to the early modern period. What happens in the wake of this shift, so in the early 16th century, is that there's this explosion of witchcraft trials. So the underlying belief that was common throughout Europe has now increased, and now since the Church is countenancing that behavior and encouraging the prosecution and trial of witches, what you get is this Great Age of European Witch Trials. The result of which is that at least some 80,000 persons between about 1550 and 1700 ended up being prosecuted for witchcraft in Europe. Most of them were convicted, and about half of those were executed for being witches. So that's the Great Age of European Witch Trials.
And that happened all over Europe? Was this going on in Spain and Finland and everywhere?
No, that's the thing. So as you sort of pointed out, that the key to understanding or the key factors that need to be explained when thinking about the Great Age of European Witch Trials have both a geographic component and a temporal component. The geographic component is that far from being evenly distributed throughout Europe, the vast majority of these trials ended up being concentrated in a relatively small area. About 60% of European witch trial activity was focused within, you know, like a 300-mile or so radius of Strasbourg, France. Countries like Spain and Italy and Portugal essentially avoided the witch trials, not completely, but almost completely. There was very, very little witch trial activity there. The temporal component, which I sort of referred to before, is that if you look at the period beginning with, let's say, 1300 or so, and going up to, say, 1850, the overwhelming majority, like 99% of it, occurs within the period between the early 16th century and the turn of the 18th century. And even within that, the vast majority of witch trial activity is concentrated in this period called the Great Hunt, which roughly falls between about 1560 and, say, 1630 to 1650, something about in that century-long era. So those are the two, sort of the temporal dimension and the geographic dimension of European witch trials that in particular beg for explanation.
Okay, so let's start begging that explanation here. I guess my thing would be, well, you know, Strasbourg is a very nice place for witches, so they all move there. And, you know, that's the place where you go persecute them. It's just kind of like going to the witch convention and, you know, persecuting witches. But there's something a little bit more to this, because it is odd that it's not distributed evenly and that there is this temporal spike for about 100, 150 years or so, beginning in the early 16th century. How have other scholars explained this phenomenon?
There's sort of three major hypotheses that exist in the historical literature in particular that are interested in trying to explain the Great Age of European witch trials. So the first of these is what's commonly called the scapegoat hypothesis. And according to the scapegoat hypothesis, more or less, this is a sort of crude characterization of it, but I think it gets to the core of what the scapegoat hypothesis is about. Bad weather was responsible for witchcraft trials in the early modern period. And the idea that, you know, bad weather, in particular colder than, there was a thing called the Little Ice Age that occurred around this period. And the idea is that those colder than expected temperatures wreaked havoc on the agricultural activity of many places in Europe. And that in turn, because people popularly believed that witches could control the weather, created economic hardship. And so these people then in turn started pointing to people around them and saying, hey, it's a witch, or he or she's a witch and is responsible for the cold weather and thus our bad crop. And that is the explanation for witch trials. That's probably the most popular and most common explanation. I do want to point out here, you know, sort of as I lay out these hypotheses, I want to point to a couple of the reasons that we think our theory works better, or the drawbacks, the limitations of these hypotheses. And with respect to the scapegoat hypothesis, there's some compelling features of it on the one hand. On the other hand, you know, there's a couple of major potential problems here. One of them is that what we document empirically, is that there's considerable variation in witch trial activity within countries. So territories that are very close to each other oftentimes exhibit very different degrees of witch trial activity. That is inconsistent with the bad weather causing witch trials scapegoat hypothesis idea, to the extent that you believe, as you probably should, that weather doesn't vary very much between neighboring territories. So that's one important limitation of the scapegoat hypothesis. The other is that it's hardly true that bad weather or economic hardship more generally was, you know, somehow unique to 16th century Europe when witch trial activity took off. There were famines and disease and bad weather, going back to the 14th century at least. We can think of some important examples there in which large parts of the population were decimated economically. And nevertheless, we don't see lots of witch trial activity in those periods of time, despite the fact that, as I mentioned earlier, there was in fact existing belief in witches. So those are some, we think, important drawbacks of the scapegoat hypothesis. The other one, I suppose, being a more practical one, when scholars have attempted to analyze that hypothesis empirically, it ended up partly because of you know, prior to the work that my co-author and I did, there wasn't comprehensive data available on this, on witch trials. They ended up excluding Germany from the study, which might not seem like such a big deal, because after all, Germany is just one country in Europe. But it turns out that Germany is responsible for more than 40% of all the witchcraft trials that happened in Europe during this period. So it's kind of an important omission.
Yeah, that's right around that 300-mile radius of Strasbourg, because Strasbourg's in eastern France, if I'm correct, right?
Yep.
Yeah. Exactly. So yeah, you can't do that. And again, you know, just methodologically thinking through this on a common sense level, that there's going to be up years and down years in terms of weather and the economy, but nonetheless, you see this rather big, huge bubble occurring at one point in time. So that's the scapegoat hypothesis. What are some of the other explanations?
Well, the second one is what is commonly called the legal centralization hypothesis. And according to that hypothesis, essentially witch trial activity constituted not quite criminal or illegal, but extra-legal activity by citizens, that it wasn't sanctioned. And so the idea is that witch trial activity declined in the 17th century as states centralized and became strong enough to essentially suppress that extra-legal activity. So that's the hypothesis. That's the legal centralization hypothesis. And that one, too, has, at least from my perspective, important limitations. Perhaps one of the most important of these is the fact that that explanation offers, or that hypothesis, offers no explanation for the emergence of European witch trial activity. So it doesn't tell us why it is that all of a sudden in the early 16th century we get this explosion in witch trial activity. It simply posits that, well, the reason that it declined in the 17th century was because states were centralizing during that period. Of course, the emergence of witch trial activity in the early 16th century is one of the central pieces on the temporal side of that phenomenon in general that requires explanation. So it's problematic from my perspective that the legal centralization hypothesis offers nothing with that in that regard. Another issue with the legal centralization hypothesis is that it basically appears and was developed largely in the context of, appears to only apply to France. So if you look at other important countries affected by witch trial activity during this period, so if you look at, for example, Germany, which, as I referred to, as I mentioned before, has had more than 40% of European witch trial activity occurring just in it alone. Or if you look at Switzerland, which is the second most witch populous country in this period. Or if you look at Belgium, you don't observe over this period between the early 16th century and the decline of witch trials in the early 18th century, you don't, in fact, observe a process of legal centralization as you do in France, which is where this hypothesis, as I mentioned before, came from. So, you know, Germany, for example, didn't become its own official state until 1800. Prior to that, it was part of the Holy Roman Empire. The old Swiss Confederacy, was also officially part of the Holy Roman Empire. It didn't form until 1400, and it didn't become officially its own separate state until 1648, when the Peace of Westphalia was adopted. Or if you look at Belgium, for example, Belgium was also a sort of one of the collection of provinces in the Holy Roman Empire going back to 1550. And what happened is that it acquires the title of the Spanish Netherlands in 1581 when its northern provinces broke off and formed the Dutch Republic, which in turn left Belgium a province within or a territory controlled by Habsburg Spain all the way until 1700. So you don't have what you have in France over these years, which is this sort of systematic state formation and centralization, which could account for the decline of witch trials in these places or in other countries throughout Europe. So that is problematic as well, that this hypothesis essentially seems to only work in one country and not in the most important country in which witch trials were present.
Okay, so that's the second one, and that seems to have its limitations. You mentioned there's a third hypothesis or set of hypotheses.
Yeah, the third hypothesis is what's called the legal torture hypothesis. And the idea here is that you could only have witch trials basically where torturous inquisitorial procedure had been adopted, because witchcraft was considered an exceptional crime that couldn't be interrogated using normal legal procedures. So you had to have inquisitorial torture, and so the idea is that in times and places that had inquisitorial torture, you were going to be able to prosecute witches, and in times and places that didn't, you wouldn't, and so you wouldn't have witches, witch trials. This is a kind of, this is actually, I think, the weakest of the existing potential explanations for European witch trial activity, in that it neither explains the emergence of the trials, it has important difficulty explaining the decline of the trials, and it also can't really explain much of the geographic variation in trial activity. So, inquisitorial, for your listeners who are unaware, inquisitorial procedure didn't emerge in continental Europe more or less until after the Fourth Lateran Council in 1215, which actually abolished trial by ordeal, which I mentioned before, and led to inquisitorial procedure on the continent and trial by jury ultimately in England. So the first thing to note there is that the torturous inquisitorial procedure emerges in 1215, but European witch trial activity doesn't take off until three centuries later. So the timing is simply way off for the emergence of witch trial activity according to this hypothesis.
Yeah.
With respect to the decline, so inquisitorial, torturous inquisitorial procedure ends up being abolished throughout Europe in the late 18th century. So, you know, between like 1750 and 1790, let's say. That's problematic too because witch trial activity across Europe has already gone into serious decline by 1650. By 1700, it's basically completely gone. So the timeline is off with respect to the decline as well. Witch trial activity simply goes away much faster than torturous inquisitorial policy does. With respect to geographic variation, the issue here is that, you know, while there was in fact heavy reliance on torturous inquisitorial procedure in Germany, for example, and in Scotland, for example, and in some other places where there was significant witch trial activity, there were the places that were, at least today, that we think of as being most closely associated with Inquisition, for example, Spain and Portugal and Italy, saw very little witch trial activity, as I mentioned earlier. So that doesn't seem to fit the picture of the legal torture hypothesis. Moreover, there was significant witch trial activity in England, and as I also mentioned earlier, when trial by ordeal was abolished in the early 13th century, what happens in England is not adoption of torturous inquisitorial procedure, but rather trial by jury. And so, nevertheless, it doesn't seem to have prevented the early modern witch craze from having crossed the English Channel. So, there are basically drawbacks on every front with respect to the legal torture hypothesis, which seems to work in a handful of countries, but certainly doesn't explain, like the other hypotheses, can't explain the general patterns that we observe both, you know, geographically and temporally with witch trials.
All right, Mr. Economist, you've knocked down the hypotheses of anthropologists, historians, and sociologists. So what do you bring to the table here in terms of explaining this temporal and geographic variation?
Well, we think that we develop a theory which is very simple, and I'll lay out for you in a second. But that theory, we think, explains both the geographic and the temporal variation, or most of it, for the great age of European witch trials. The way to think about, the sort of motivate thinking about our argument is to go back to some work of some previous economists who have emphasized that, at least in the context of Christian religion, that competition between religious producers, if you want to think about it that way, between various churches, takes place in the context of a religious output or a good, if you can think about a good being produced for religious consumers, whose fundamental qualities and features are inscrutable to those consumers, are not observable to them. And that religious output or good that we have in mind, or that these authors have in mind, is what we call salvation, but it's essentially, you know, simply the sort of status of a member of a particular religion in the afterlife, whether they go to heaven or hell or purgatory or somewhere else. Churches, especially historically, make claims about, you know, what's going to be the state of one's soul in the afterlife, depending upon what they do in the current world, including which religion they follow. But there's, of course, no way for potential religious consumers to determine if, in fact, what they're saying is true or not until at least after they've died. So, because of that, this existing work has rightly emphasized, we think, the fact that there with respect to religious competition, there's an important problem because people's decisions to purchase or to consume from a certain faith, from a certain church, depend upon their simple faith, their belief that that church or that religious producer is telling the truth with respect to the quality of their religious output, namely that following their denomination, for example, will result probabilistically or possibly in the person's safety in the afterlife. So with that sort of in mind, what we do is we say, okay, well, might we be able to think about, in that context, various ways in which competing religious producers would try to capture market share, try to compete with one another, given that they can't do so in one of the typical ways that you would find in an ordinary market, which is by producing a higher quality good and then showing consumers, being able to tangibly demonstrate to them that, look, my good is of a higher quality. And our idea is that, well, although salvation is not observable, that quality is not observable to potential religious consumers, what is potentially observable is whether or not a religious producer is able to protect you from evil or perceived evil in the current world. And witch trials, we think, as I'll explain in a second, are a way in which religious producers can do that. They permit them to establish observable quality dimensions for their religious output that are closely related to that salvation dimension, but are not the same. And on the basis of that, they are able to compete for market share from religious consumers. So the background of this, which is perhaps obvious given what we were just talking about a moment ago, but the background for this is that you only need to engage in competitive activities, such as potentially witch trials, if in fact you face a religious rival, if you need to compete with another religion for religious market share. For most of the Middle Ages, leading up to the Protestant Reformation, the Catholic Church had more or less a monopoly on religious production in Christendom. And so there wasn't particular need most of the time for them to be engaging in any kind of competitive activity. Now there are some exceptions to this. So, in the medieval period, you have these heretical groups, such as the Cathars and the Waldenses, that emerge that sort of are encroaching potentially on the church's turf by basically claiming that the church is not, the only way to salvation, and that, in fact, perhaps following some of the church teachings might result in you having a nasty afterlife rather than a good one. And so to sort of deal with these, the church ends up applying a couple of different strategies, but the principal one of them is very straightforward, which is simply, coercion. They use annihilation, so they launch the Albigensian Crusade and the medieval Inquisition to eliminate their potential religious rivals and silence them. So fast forward now to the early 16th century, when for the first time the church faces, as a result of the Protestant Reformation, real competition on a serious scale. The first thing you might think is that, well, what the church would want to do to deal with these competitors, to make sure that it doesn't lose some of its market share, is to simply annihilate them coercively as it did with the Cathars and the Waldenses. And my co-author and I think that that's right, that that's what the church wanted to do. However, for a variety of reasons, historical, they were unable to do so successfully. And all of those reasons sort of boil down to the fact that the Protestant Reformation captured the interest and imagination of a large number of secular rulers throughout the Holy Roman Empire in particular, but Europe more generally, very quickly after 1517 when it was catalyzed by Luther. And so you have basically, in many areas throughout Europe, very quickly, you have rulers who are sympathetic to or who have already completely adopted the Reformed faith. That's important because if the church doesn't have religious loyalty in a particular country, it's not going to be able to rely on inquisitions and crusades, which require the support and participation of secular rulers in order to administrate them. So in areas where where basically religious competition is very strong, as it was in most of Europe shortly following the Reformation's introduction, you don't have the ability of the church to rely on coercive exclusion. There are some exceptions to this. So Italy or Portugal, or Spain, for example, there the church was able to retain its stronghold on religious market share. Protestantism never made important inroads in those countries. They were Catholic strongholds. And so as a result, there the church could and did deal with the weak religious competition it confronted from Protestantism simply through this coercive exclusion, this annihilation function, which is exactly what they did. That's why we have the Portuguese Inquisition, the Spanish Inquisition, and the Roman Inquisition. In the rest of Europe, though, the Catholic Church is not able to compete with Protestantism on those grounds. And so what it does, we suggest, is it ends up resorting to witch trial activity as a way to advertise and evidence its ability to undecided religious consumers, that it is both willing and able to protect them from Satan's evil or perceived threats of Satan's evil that those citizens have, that those consumers have in this world. Shortly after the church starts adopting this procedure, Protestants get in on the act too, and what we have in the end is a sort of witch trial advertising campaign where you've got both denominations engaged in the activity for the same reason, we argue, trying to lure religious customers to their side, and both doing so on the basis of the idea that if religious consumers in a potential area think that various people in their community, for example, are witches, and they point to them as witches, what these religious authorities can do, Catholic or Protestant, is to come in and, if they prosecute that person, evidence their willingness, as I mentioned, and their ability, if they in fact convict them, to protect those citizens against evils from those citizens' own perspective. So these denominations, the confessions, do not have to somehow concoct witch beliefs or concoct demand for witch trials. All they have to do is to leverage the existing beliefs and demand of citizens for witch trial activity, and in doing so, they end up satisfying those consumers.
It's a great explanation, and I fully buy this, and I want to bring up Latin America in a little bit here. Actually, I'm going to bring it up now, because as I was reading your paper, I kept thinking about my own dissertation, where Latin America was pretty much a safe haven for Catholicism from the time of the colonization until, you know, roughly the early 20th century, maybe mid-20th century. And as soon as Protestants started breaking into the market, you saw the same thing going on. The first response was coercion. Let's just try to beat them down. But if you weren't able to do that, you turn to some other means of signaling your credibility. And one of the things that I argued is they didn't undertake witch trials at the time. And it might be because, well, the states were pretty strong by then. So it goes back to one of those earlier hypotheses about state strength and capacity, that they don't want people independently doing witch trials. But they basically attacked other evils. The Catholic Church, we're going to protect you from the evils of these dictators and the economic policies that they have, et cetera, et cetera. So it seems to be a very transportable type of theory.
Yeah, I think that the example that you raise is a very good one, and I think it's a pretty general, you know, its fundamental features are pretty widely applicable. The underlying logic is simply that where you've got some incumbent monopolist or some incumbent power, whether it be religious or political or otherwise, who wants to protect their market share in the face of potential competition, that it's in their interest and that they will do what they can, oftentimes through public trials, although not necessarily exclusively through them, but oftentimes through public trials of a variety of forms, in order to evidence their willingness and ability to basically suppress potential threats to their position of power and to evidence their superiority from the perspective of citizens or their would-be followers. And, you know, in our paper on witch trials, my co-author and I point to a few examples, historical examples, that we think this logic helps to explain.
Yeah, give us a flavor for some of those, because they're great. Because once you start thinking about your hypothesis and you say, well, this just relates to witch trials in the 16th century, it's very limited theory. Once you start bringing up these other examples, you go, wow, this is really generalizable about human behavior. So what are some of these other examples?
Well, the first one that occurred to us as we were working on this paper was Stalin's show trials, and Mao had similar show trials. They were common in socialist countries. The idea, the show trials outcomes were already known to everyone before they were performed, which has often made them somewhat of a mystery to scholars, although scholars have understood that, nevertheless, these trials performed or must have performed some important propaganda purpose. And we think that propaganda purpose fits very well within the context of the theory of witch trial activity as religious competition, or as reflecting activities to sort of rebut potential competition. Here too, we think that Stalin's show trials, for example, were used as a way to publicly communicate to citizens in the Soviet Union, deciding whose faction, Stalin's or the Trotskyists, for example, to sort of get behind. Demonstrating them who in fact had more power. So that's one of the examples that we have in mind. There's another example which is closer in spirit to religious competition that witch trials reflected, which is this infamous trial of the 10th century called the cadaver trial. So the 9th and 10th centuries were particularly fractious times for would-be pontiffs. There was a lot of competition for becoming the pope. In fact, some candidates were murdered in this process, and a bunch of popes during this period had very short tenures because of the intense rivalry to accede to the papacy. And during this period of time, there was a Pope Formosus who had recently died, who was tried by his predecessor. His carcass was tried by his predecessor, Pope Stephen VI, who propped up the carcass in the Basilica of St. Peter and asked it, among its other questions, pointed queries, why did you usurp the throne of the papacy? And what he was doing, this was done before an ecclesiastic audience, what Pope Stephen VI was doing was using a public trial of a carcass, in this case, in order to highlight the fact that even potential rivals who might want to, for example, take Stephen VI's position, potential papal rivals who are deceased, who attempt to, through machinations, oust him from his position of power and put themselves in, will face this fate of being publicly humiliated, in this case tried and excommunicated. So he was convicted of his crime and excommunicated at the cadaver, that is.
Yeah, the posthumously excommunicated.
That's another example.
Yeah, that is one of the great examples in there. And this is one of the things that you do with your research, is that going through the historical evidence, you find these really interesting stories in the cadaver trial. I'd never heard of this at all. And I had wished I had been there at the time to observe this, because you got this dead body. It's been interned for about a year, and they dig the thing back up and put it up there on a chair. I'm wondering if there was somebody as a puppet in behind there, doing the mouth or something. I don't know. It would just be absolutely fascinating to if there was video of that kind of thing. One of the other things that crossed my mind, and this wasn't in your paper, but I'd just get your thoughts on that. Do you think what's going on in our contemporary political world today might have some bearing, or your explanation might have some bearing on it? I'm thinking about recently John Boehner stepped down as Speaker of the House, and we know that there's this competition for the quote-unquote soul of the Republican Party between Tea Party folks and the mainstream or the mainline Republicans and that. Do you think you could get any traction with your theory to help explain that?
Well, maybe. I don't follow contemporary politics at all, so I'm not the best person to ask that question to. However, it's certainly, our theory generally suggests that where you have strong competitive pressures, where you've got strong contestation, which it sounds like would apply to the contemporary political situation you described, that one or both parties is likely to engage in some, not exclusively, but oftentimes trial activity as a way of advertising basically their superiority, as a way of attracting support for their position. So it sounds like you'd be in a better position than I to know if this applies to Boehner, but it sounds like it might.
Yeah, I think there's a paper in this for other scholars or for graduate students out there, because again, you're dealing with this issue of credence goods, right? They're selling an ideology or a package of political promises that are difficult to verify for anybody, and so you need to find other tangible ways to demonstrate your credibility in that regard. So, interesting stuff. I just want to just briefly, before we move to our next topic, talk about how you went about proving your theory and examining your theory, because you did something that's really cool. You put together this big, I don't know what to call it, witchy poo database or something like that. Tell us how you actually went about in testing your theory.
Sure. So this is where my co-author deserves most of the credit here. He collected data from historical sources on what ended up being 43,000 persons accused of witchcraft and tried for witchcraft across 353 counties in Europe over 5.5 centuries between 1300 and 1850. So the result is a tremendous, the largest by far to date database on witch trials, which allows us to examine our theory empirically. And what our theory suggests is that, well, in the times and places in Europe where religious competition between Catholics and Protestants is stronger, that we should observe more witch trial activity, and where it's weaker, we should observe less. So that means that at the start of the Reformation, we should observe witch trial activity really taking off. In the middle of the 16th century, it should spike because of this treaty called the Treaty of Augsburg, which we argue really inflamed political competition between Catholics and Protestants. And then around 1650, it predicts that you should observe this decline in witch trial activity because the Peace of Westphalia was adopted, which basically created permanent territorial confessional monopolies throughout Europe. So it wasn't possible anymore or very difficult for Catholics and Protestants to compete and obtain increase their market share as a result. So that's the sort of temporal prediction. The geographic prediction is that in countries where religious competition was stronger, for example, the Reformation's origin country, Germany, or in Switzerland, we should observe more witch trial activity. And in places where confessional competition was weak, as in Italy, for example, in Spain and Portugal that I mentioned before, we should observe less witch trial activity. So to examine that, we take that database that I mentioned, and the first thing we do is we map throughout Europe and over time witch trial activity, and our measure for confessional competition is actually religious battle. So we look at the 9 European wars of religion, and we collect data on the battles that those European wars of religion reflected, and then we plot those on the map against the witch trial activity. And the result is pretty strong. I mean, it's a pretty compelling, we think, picture of the positive relationship between the intensity of witch trial activity and the intensity of confessional competition that our theory predicts.
It is a great paper, and we are going to point people back to your website again. So please visit our website to find Peter Leeson's website, because you will be able to read this. I think the paper's online now. Is it not? Or
the paper is actually not up yet because we're still working on on providing more empirical tests for our theory, but it's not up yet, but it will be soon.
It will be soon, and people should check out your website because there's other stuff that's up there. That is absolutely fascinating. And I want to turn with our last 15 minutes here on the podcast to another paper that would seem to be way, way outside of the purview of economics. You know, the witch trial stuff, I can get it. Competition between competing religious firms. Okay, that fits in the economic framework. In fact, I've done some of this stuff, so I buy into that. But human sacrifice? You try to use economics to explain why people just killed people? What is going on with this one? Please explain.
Well, I should point out first that this project, this has happened with a few of my projects, but this one in particular, I had a very difficult time with publishing because many people's reactions were not criticisms of the argument or showing problems with my evidence. It was simply, this is crazy. This seems insane. So I think, you know, this one really took it to the limit, which makes me very proud of it. And the basic idea is not crazy at all. So at least that's the argument of the paper. The basic idea is that human sacrifice, which in this case refers to the purchase and then ritual immolation of the people who are purchased, which is an important part of the purchase first. This is not like Aztec human sacrifice, which was sacrifice of criminals and political enemies. It was what communities would do. And this, by the way, is in 19th century, what was then called Orissa, now Odisha, India. What communities would do would be to purchase innocent persons from, usually they were often children, though not always, from outside the community, and then they would viciously murder them in a public ceremony, ostensibly to appease an Earth goddess who wanted the blood of innocent people. So it's horrendous, right? But the economic logic is actually not, as I argue, insane at all. What human sacrifice in this context reflects was simply an efficient technology of property rights protection. And so the easiest way to understand the logic is to relay to you a sort of very, very quick example of something from my own life, which happened relatively recently in the past year or so. So I live in a very old condominium, and the public space, sort of, you know, the foyer area where you enter the building and the elevator has not been updated since the building was constructed in like 1980. So it is absolutely dilapidated and looks terrible. And many of the residents of the condo have been wanting to, you know, refurbish it and update it because it's embarrassing and looks terrible. And so at a condo meeting last year, we got together to discuss what it would look like and you know, the fee structure for residents. And one of the older women who lives in my condo raised her hand, and she said that she was against improving the lobby area and the elevator. And when people asked her why, she said, well, given its current state of dilapidation, no thief would ever try and break into this building and attempt to steal from anybody here because they would assume that the people here have absolutely nothing worth stealing. And I thought to myself, that's peculiar. And then I thought to myself, actually, that makes a lot of sense. So her thinking was that it's cheaper to basically leave our condominium in a state of disarray, right, in a state inferior to what it could be in, rather than to, for example, install a security system to try and prevent potential thieves from breaking into our building and stealing from residents. So the logic there is that sometimes it's cheaper to reduce the gross asset of a value, to destroy some of your property, than it would be which in turn makes it a less attractive target of plunder to would-be plunderers, than it is to defend against those plunderers in other ways. And that's the simple logic that lies behind the practice of human sacrifice. So the people in question, the communities in question were agricultural communities, as they mentioned in 19th century India. And the thing about agricultural activity, especially at this time, is that it whether or not a community does well or not depends upon, you know, the caprices of nature. It's entirely random. You might get good weather in a year, in which case you've got a bountiful harvest. You might get terrible weather in another year, in which case you basically have nothing. And the difficulty here is that this was an anarchic environment in which these communities operated. There was no government that overreached them or overarched them, I should say, to enforce property rights. And so there was considerable warfare between the communities. In particular, communities that happened to have a bad crop because, say, they experienced bad weather would want to plunder the communities that did well because they got good weather. And so that war activity was very costly for both sides. You know, it killed a lot of people got killed and it destroyed a lot of property in the process. So I argue that what communities in this society did was that they preemptively destroyed part of their wealth in order to prevent other communities who received that bad shock of weather, for example, from attacking them, from trying to seize the additional harvest that they got. There are many details to the argument, but that's the basic logic.
Yeah. Absolutely fascinating. To what extent, I mean, you expanded this argument to your condominium and such, but to what extent does that transport to other areas too?
I mean, I think it transports in different ways to tons of areas. So here's another example. This is another one from my life. But when I was in graduate school, my dissertation advisor, God bless him, bought me, because I had no money, a car so that I could get to campus. And that car was a 1982 Honda Civic, which was, you know, an absolute piece of junk, but it got me where I was going. So there was nothing desirable about this car, except for one peculiar feature. The guy that he bought it from, I think he bought the car for $500, if I remember right. The guy that he bought the car from had installed this really fancy and elaborate stereo, and I have no idea. So it was this hunk of junk car with this fancy stereo inside. So one time when I was, shortly after I got it, I was coming out of campus, I saw somebody trying to break into my car, which I couldn't believe. I was astonished. I thought, why would anybody want to break into this 1982 Honda Civic? And then I remembered the stereo. So I didn't have enough money to, you know, install a security system on the car, nor was it worthwhile to sort of stand around and monitor the 82 Honda Civic all day. So what I did was I removed the stereo from my car. That was a way of depressing the value, the gross value of the car. I destroyed effectively part of my property in order to preserve the better part of it, which was the part that mattered to me, the car's ability to get me around. That's another example. Or, you know, many of your listeners, maybe if they've traveled to a foreign country or somewhere even in the United States that is, say, less safe, may have had the thought, you know, before to leave some of their property behind, maybe their favorite piece of jewelry or a watch or something along those lines, to not bring it with them on the grounds that it might be taken from them. That is effectively destroying part of your property value in order to preserve it. So when you buy a piece of jewelry, part of its value is your ability to wear it whenever you want. If when you're traveling abroad, you leave it at home, you can't ever recoup that value that's lost, the ability to have worn your jewelry in whatever country you were traveling in. So you're destroying effectively part of the value of your property, but you're doing so because it ends up protecting that property's safety overall. So I think that there are lots of examples when you start to think about the broader application of the logic. You just have to look around a little bit using economic logic to find them.
And this is why you are one of my favorite economists, because you are able to connect 1982 Honda Civics to some old lady in a condominium to human sacrifice in 19th century India, which is just, you know, people again would go, what? But the underlying economic logic is there. And by taking some of these oddball examples, as many people would call it, and as you said, you had a hard time publishing this thing because, well, you know, it's kind of strange. But it does perk up people's ears and then really gets them to think deeply about these topics. And the stuff you do just absolutely does that. And I'm really glad that you have taken up the charge of doing this. And that brings me to the last question that I want to ask you, and this is one that I frequently ask my guests, is just to do a little bit of self-reflection. You've been at this game for, you know, two decades or more, studying economics and applying it to very odd areas. Over that time, have you changed your mind on anything? I mean, you've had aha moments where you never thought you would think that way, but all of a sudden you did think that way?
I have. They're probably not aha moments that you would expect, but so I'm very influenced in my thinking by Austrian economics, so the economics of Ludwig von Mises and F.A. Hayek in particular. And one of the things, and so I used to be much more, my thinking used to be much more critical of what I would call sort of conventional mainstream neoclassical economics, which focuses on comparative statics and partial equilibrium analysis, in contrast to Austrian economics' emphasis on process, for example. I still am completely sold on the Austrian argument, but in terms of doing applied work, I have become much less critical of the sort of conventional approach, simply because I have found through my own work that those tools are the easiest tools and the most productive tools for me personally to apply oftentimes in explaining phenomena. So I don't know if I'd call it a change of mind, but it is a definite and substantial shift sort of in my thinking and the focus of my work, which sometimes I think has bothered some people and maybe others have been okay with it, but I think it's an evolution of my thinking. I don't know if that makes sense, but, or if that's the sort of thing you were looking for, but that's the first thing that comes to my mind.
Yeah. And one of those things that you do very well is bother other people with the topics that you study and the way that you study them. And that is actually a sign of a very productive and intellectually engaged academic. And so I want to thank you for your great body of work. And I want to turn all our listeners to your webpage, because it is filled with a lot of papers that are very interesting, and not only very interesting, but very readable as well. So these things are not the, you know, things you think about in a typical academic setting where it has tons of equations and formal models. You do a lot of that, of course, but you also write in such a way that engages a broad audience. And again, I mentioned the pirate book, The Invisible Hook, early on, and that is one of my favorite books because it is so engaging and explains a lot of these things in a way that everybody can understand. So I want to congratulate you for your work, and we look forward to doing more stuff. We're going to get you back on to talk about rat trials, vermin trials later on, because that paper just blows my mind. But and anyways, my guest today has been Pete Leeson. Pete, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
Thank you, Tony. I had a great time and I really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.